This week on Straight Talk Africa, Sudan marks 1 year of civil war, a conflict that has displaced many and pushed 18 million to the brink of starvation. What is the international community doing? Is this a forgotten war? 30 years ago in Rwanda, the genocide ravaged the nation. In 100 days, over 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, were massacred. We'll hear from an eyewitness, Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, who stood firm and disobeyed orders to help those persecuted, while the international community did little. Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Vincent McCorry. What we call the international communities, such as the United Nations, the UN Security Council, the African Union, functions as a gatekeeper of order, human rights and justice. But how effective are these gatekeepers in de-escalating conflict? Big conflicts, especially the ones that involve superpowers, are always on the radar of these organizations and are covered by international media. This is true of Russia's war in Ukraine or the Israeli-Hamas war. But sometimes there are conflicts that go unnoticed in countries that do not attract media attention. In 1994, Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire was leading the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda. He witnessed a genocide that he wanted to stop. The UN ordered him to withdraw and not to intervene. He did exactly the opposite. General Dallaire, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much.
Now, to begin with, at that time, we were looking back 30 years ago. When exactly did you realize that the situation was getting out of hand?
Well, my first warning to the international community through the UN was on the 11th of January when informants, credible informants, told us that there would be mass killings and that the stalling of the political process was going to exacerbate the situation for this to essentially explode. I was prevented from intervening in order to stop the arms shipments and to try to destabilize the subversive elements that were not signatories to the peace agreement. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the situation going catastrophic was immediately when I got the report that the presidential plane had been shot down the night of the 6th. Within less than an hour, I was at the headquarters of the government forces, and it was obvious right then and there that I was watching a coup d'etat and a scenario that would go out of hand.
Now, General, you were asked by headquarters to get out of Rwanda. As a soldier, you're supposed to obey direct orders. Why did you decide to stay?
There are times in these complex and ambiguous missions and mandates, particularly in the early 90s when we were into a whole new realm of imploding nations and failing states versus state against state, which we essentially saw during the Cold War, that orders could be maybe legal, but they also could be immoral. And instinctively, we already had, by the time I got the order, which was nearly 3 weeks into the genocide, from the Secretary General to pull out because he had heard from the ex-colonial powers that we were going to be wiped out, the few troops I had left. There was no way that we were going to abandon the 32,000 people who had fallen under our protection in our different sites. And so there was no discussion, debate. It was right from the gut. No, we're not leaving. We're not going to abandon them. Uh-huh. And we're staying.
That was extraordinary bravery and humanity. But what kind of help did you need? And when did you realize you're not going to get that help?
Well, I within the first 48 hours, as the scenario had been described to me, when I even went to a meeting of all the senior officers of the government forces and how they were not going to stop the situation. On the contrary, they were going to war. And so at that point, I knew that what had been predicted as mass atrocities, and we'd already seen ethnic cleansing going on in Yugoslavia, that I needed reinforcements. And my original plan of 5,000 troops was what I asked for. On the contrary, saw within about 10 days of my request for reinforcements that countries were pulling out their forces because they didn't want to be involved in a catastrophic failure of a mission that was supposed to be for a peace process under Chapter 6, but was turning into, in fact, outright civil war and mass atrocities. And this is right after, if you remember, Mogadishu and the Americans did exactly that when they lost their soldiers in October of 93.
Now, one would expect that that is exactly the time when the international community should come in rather than pull out. What kind of explanation at the UN level was being given for just standing by and watching as people massacre?
Well, in fact, that's a very good question, because it starts really with the nation states that make up the UN. They sent in some people to take a look at the situation within the first week, and every one of them that came, and I got debriefed, told me, listen, we're not coming in because there's nothing here. There's no strategic resources of anything. The only thing that's here are human beings, and one even said that there was too many of them. Anyways, it was overpopulated. So the human factor from the nation states that provide the assets to the UN to be able to react were not interested whatsoever, led by the Belgians and the French, and also led by the Americans with their experience from Mogadishu. And so nobody was going to give the UN any support, even in the Security Council, where I argued that this was mass atrocities that were genocide, because they had worked that out with my colleague from the International Red Cross, that we went through the books and said, hey, this is exactly what's happening.
That was frustrating. Now, tell us briefly, you eventually had to leave, but how did those events affect you, and how have you gone on since then?
I have I've been just under 25 years of therapy. I still take 9 pills a day, and I still have flashbacks. Because what we discovered at that time was not just the PTSD, which is a injury of the mind from often spontaneous scenarios, you know, ambushes or even a car accident could cause that. But what we were involved in this new era of world disorder was, in fact, moral injuries. That is to say, things that go fundamentally against every grain of every reference that you have as a human being. And so when you have soldiers that have to shoot children in order to prevent them as suicide bombers from blowing up a convoy, this just doesn't disappear. The best you can hope for is establishing a sort of prosthesis with peer support, love in a family, and medication and therapy. And so many soldiers, until we told them that it was, yeah, an honorable injury to be injured in the mind because of what we're seeing, many of them simply went off and committed suicide or drank themselves nearly to oblivion.
Really sad. Now, Rwanda is home to the Dallaire Institute for Children, Peace and Security. Tell us a little bit how you ended up setting up this and why it is important to you.
The realization, and it came even stronger after I'm reviewing in my mind and also preparing for the International Tribunal, which I testified a number of times on the genocide, is that the bulk of the killing had been done by youths. Youth that had been in a sort of a political party youth movement that had been shifted and indoctrinated into a militia. And so it was youths with machetes that did most of the killing. And so I started to review what I had seen and noticed that it was youth on one side that were doing the killing, and there were youth on the other side that were being used as soldiers. And so the use of children as instruments of war just threw me completely off. And so I did a year fellowship at the Kennedy School at Harvard, did the research I needed to build a program in which we could educate and train security forces, police and military, in new tactical structures in trying to stop the use of children, make them an ineffective weapon of war, and also convince the communities to not let their children be recruited to do so. And that has expanded now, not only in Africa, where we cover all of Africa, but now I open up in South America to cover all of Latin America, including Haiti. Mm-hmm. And we recently just were in Australia to open up Asia.
You know, General Dallaire, what an extraordinary human being you are. Thank you very much for your time with us.
Very good questions. Well done. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire led the UN peacekeeping mission for Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. Now, coming up after the break on Straight Talk Africa, Sudan marked 1 year of civil war that has displaced 8 million people. And there is fear that the conflict is spilling across borders. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Neurotypical peers, women with autism can learn to live independently, build career, start a business, and more. Researchers say women with autistic spectrum condition can be a huge asset to a workplace due to their strong ability to solve problems or their direct approach to communication. However, understanding their needs is key to success. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss what success means to an autistic woman. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. It's been a year since war broke out in Sudan, and analysts foresee no end to the conflict and say the longer it drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorist groups. VOA spoke via Skype to a volunteer at one of the last functioning hospitals in Omdurman, and Henry Wilkins reports.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has ravaged Sudan's twin cities of Khartoum, its capital, and Omdurman, its largest. Millions have fled the metropolitan area because of the fighting. Some have stayed, however, either because they don't have the means to leave, or in a few cases, because they chose to stay and help. Momen Ahmed Abbas volunteers at one of Omdurman's last functional hospitals and refuses to flee the city.
I cannot abandon them, especially when they rely on my support. Thus, I remain to ensure that injured individuals have access to essentials like food, shelter, and medical care. Leaving would only exacerbate the situation for those in need.
He says the situation is desperate at the hospital, which lacks medical supplies and security, and is vulnerable to frequent airstrikes and fighting. Humanitarian groups and international journalists have found entry into Khartoum and many other parts of Sudan all but impossible. And as a result, the world's awareness of the country's troubles has diminished. Commentators and diplomats often refer to Sudan's conflict as the world's forgotten war, despite as many as 16,000 people estimated to have died because of the conflict and 8.6 million forcibly displaced. Analysts say pressure from the international community is needed to bring the warring sides to the negotiating table. But one doesn't see that happening anytime soon.
Sadly, I don't see this conflict as particularly ripe for any kind of resolution right now. Both sides think either that they can win or they have to win. And as long as they continue to be sustained by external actors, providing them weapons and intelligence, then they're going to continue this fight.
A recent U.S. intelligence report says the longer the war drags on, the more likely Saddam will become a breeding ground for terrorists. One analyst who spoke to VOA echoed this view.
You got young people and they have all the fuel. They have the anger, they have the ethnic division, and then they have whatever the narrative about there is a just war happening somewhere.
Leaders of both warring sides are wildly unpopular among most Sudanese. Neither has ever been democratically elected. Yet Sudanese civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of the ongoing fighting. Abbas says Sudan needs external help and intervention.
We desperately need international support to address the crisis in Sudan. Awareness must be raised about the ongoing suffering and devastation.
Yet, after 1 year of fighting in Sudan, it seems clear that no substantial help is on its way. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
This is more than a conflict between two warring parties. It is a war being waged on the Sudanese people. It is a war on the many thousands of civilians who have been killed and tens of thousands maimed for life. It is a war on the 18 million people facing acute hunger and the communities now standing down the terrifying threat of famine in the months ahead.
With me to help us gain some insight into the situation in Sudan is Samer Salman, a Sudanese strategist, strategic analyst, and Wokne Gebeyehu, Executive Secretary of the Intercontinental Authority on Development, IGAD. Welcome to Straight Africa, both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, we've watched the package went on. It's been a year since the war in Sudan began. I want to start with you, Samer. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who just spoke, has warned that things are getting worse and there could be actually serious violations taking place. What have been the main obstacles to getting to any semblance of peace in Sudan?
Thank you. You know, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the outset of the war was very clear about the devastation. And he said the scale and speed of Sudan's descent into death and destruction is unprecedented. I think there have been three main obstacles. The first, and I wouldn't necessarily call it an obstacle, but I think there's an opportunity there, is that we've seen a proliferation of different initiatives and mechanisms. One is the AU expanded mechanism, another is the U.S. Jeddah peace talks, another is the neighboring countries initiative being led by Egypt. And what we would really like to see is an alignment and integration of these mechanisms so that we have one unified, coherent mechanism for these international allies to come together to help us end this war. And the strength of that unity is really what we need at the moment.
Yes.
The second is the UN Security Council. We really call on the UN Security Council to call out those countries that are violating the UN arms embargo, the Sudan arms, the Darfur arms embargo. I mean, the panel of experts has documented violations of the arms embargo. And so we really need the Security Council to act on this. Mm-hmm. And I think the third is the ICC. The ICC is currently investigating war crimes and atrocities in Darfur, and they started to look at expanding their mandate to cover all of Sudan, because the atrocities are now being committed across the entire country. And so we need the UN Security Council to back this as well.
Now, Wakne, you know, the regional mechanisms to, you know, resolving conflicts has been a hope for many. IGAD was actually early this year, I believe, involved in trying to, you know, mediate between the warring sides. But sometime earlier this year, Sudan decided it's going to suspend its membership in IGAD. Can you tell us a little bit about why that was the case and how far IGAD has been successful or not successful in trying to broker peace between the two sides?
Thank you very much. It's unfortunate. It is 1 year and 2 days after the outbreak of this one of the ugliest conflicts in our region, which made us to lose one of the biggest countries of the region, the continent and the world. After this conflict happened, IGAD was the first regional organization or international organization which called an urgent meeting of the heads of states and governments to mediate this situation. Unfortunately, either IGAD or African Union or United Nations, we were not successful to stop this conflict and displacement and deaths in Sudan. This is the most important reason is the lack of political will from the warring parties, the belligerents. Yes, the mediators, including IGAD, African Union, you know, they're trying their best to bring these parties to the table. We did five heads of states meetings, series of meetings, which invited both generals to the table of discussion. And we are still continuing to that. Yes, IGAD, Sudan has said that they are suspending their membership from IGAD. But, you know, IGAD, Sudan is a family of IGAD, a founding member of IGAD. And
actually, IGAD is a very small family.
Yes, very small family. Family of neighbors. So,
exactly.
So now yeah. they cannot suspend according to the rule and regulation of IGAD. One country to suspend or to make some kind of decision, unilateral decision, there are a process, legal processes. But I don't want to discuss thing, whether it is a political statement or...
I wanted to talk about the fact that you're here in Washington, actually,
yes,
attending the IMF World Bank meetings. And in those meetings, there are also meetings with ministers, right, from the region. Can you tell us about the collaboration and what kind of talks we can expect to happen between IGAD and those interested parties?
Yeah, I know the day before yesterday I was in Paris for, you know, for humanitarian pledge for Sudanese. Let me mention this thing here. Before 1 year and 2 days before, Sudan was one of the biggest host of refugees in that continent. Millions of the citizens of neighboring countries was living in Sudan. Now, millions of Sudanese are out of their home, out of their country, and significant number of these are dead. Number one, we are trying to work with all the international partners, including here, we are here, from IGAD member states and different world. The most important point is, in spite of our integration agenda, the peace and security agenda is very important because we have a deficit of peace in our region. Specifically, we are talking about Sudan. You know, reinforcing the peace in the Republic of South Sudan, reinforcing the Somalia situation, and so on and so forth. So IGAD is working on that. We are going to discuss on that. Most importantly, this is a World Bank meeting, yearly meeting, we focus on how to bring the effort of the member states for economic integration, for how to maximize the infrastructure as well.
Yeah, you can never attain that if there is instability in any of the countries. And actually, at the moment, quite a number of countries, members of IGAD, are going through different forms of instability. Going back to Salma, you know, in most conflicts, typically, it is a government fighting a rebel group or some form of opposition. Now, in Sudan, what we are seeing is actually two factions of the army, generals who work together. How does this play out in terms of the civilians? What role is any civilian organization playing, and how does it impact how they align themselves with the sides that are in war?
Yeah, this is a really important question. But if I just may refer back to the World Bank meetings, actually during the pledging conference, it was announced that $555 million was pledged by the World Bank, and about $2 billion in total has now been pledged during the Paris conference. So we thank Dr. Workne and all of the international community for this pledge. I think that's very important because Sudan is currently the largest humanitarian crisis. But to your question, right now what we're seeing, how we're seeing this manifest, is very dangerous because both the SAF and the RSF have initiated large recruitment drives of young men and young women to each of their armies. And so what they're doing now is actually mobilizing and incentivizing the Sudanese people to join the fight. And what we're seeing is an increase of arms coming into the country. And so we're looking at this transform itself from a war between two security factions to a civil war. And that's incredibly dangerous because you will see this war then become protracted and spread possibly to neighboring countries. So that is in terms of the people of Sudan. In terms of civilian organizations, I would say that civilian organizations right now are in survival mode. Right now we are facing what could be the largest famine in recent history.
Mm-hmm. Because, again, IGAD is very critical to not only the development of the region, but stabilization of the region. And without a stable region, we cannot have development. Can you kind of briefly talk about the levels of collaboration that you have at the moment at the region that is strengthening any capacity to resolve some of those conflicts? Because the perception of some is that countries in Africa are unable to actually collaborate and bring about peace and sometimes even development.
Yeah, IGAD is a family organization which is ruled by principles and regulations. Yes, indeed, we have challenges, but let me mention, remind to you some of the success histories of IGAD. You know, the South Sudanese Revitalized Agreement, the current government who is now in power, is broker. The midwife of that peace agreement was IGAD. The peace in Somalia, it was IGAD. The peace in Ethiopia, it's IGAD. So we have extensive experience of dealing with the conflicts which happened in our member states. This is because of the political will of our member states. The reason why IGAD was established, the reason why IGAD is, you know, working with our member states is, number one, to secure, you know, to help our member states in terms of peace and security. So that's what we are doing. That's what we are doing in Sudan. That is what we did in Ethiopia and other countries.
I wish we had more time,
yes.
But we're going to end it.
Yeah.
I'll leave it right there. We want to thank you very much, both of you, for being on this show. Now, Sama, Sudanese strategic analyst, and Workne Gebeyehu, executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority and Development. Thanks to all our affiliate stations bringing you Straight Talk Africa across the continent. I'll see you next time.
Thank you.